Welcome to the School of Hollywood, where you'll hear success stories, Hollywood tips, and advice in entertainment. I'm Steve Owens, your host. I've worked as a movie, TV, music producer, talent manager, a former agent, and have earned 43 platinum gold records. Today, Kyle Larson, a recipient of Hollywood Foreign Press Award and the Stanley Kramer Directing Award, is here in the house. He has also worked as a development executive at Brad Pitt's Plan B Entertainment and currently produces television for Big Beach. Let's hear about Kyle's latest project, which is an Oscar contender. Hi, it's Steve Owens with School of Hollywood, and today we have director Kyle Larson of the Oscar contender, Josiah, an incredible film. I could read the storyline to everybody, but I'd rather hear your elevator pitch since you're an executive producer as well and you were a head of development.
Oh, yeah. It's a film about an actor who walks into a casting session and into audition for a period part in a period television series. I think it attempts to excavate some of the blind spots and flaws and faults that are potentially inherent in creative process, because it's very human driven. And it's really about the collision of four different perspectives inside of one room.
Luke Forbes' expressions were classic as he's hearing, you know, the director, you know, kind of give him the storyline. And when he's talking about, can you ride a horse? It's like, you know, dude, I'm here to get a job. Okay, I'm going to lie to you and tell you what you want to hear, you know, as every actor does in the room. But after I watched the movie, I sat and thought about it. And, you know, the stereotyping that we've had for so many years in Hollywood, you really, really hit the nail on the head with this project. And immediately after I watched it, I got on the phone and called one of my producer partners. And I said, you've got to put Kyle on the radar. He is going to win the Oscar this year for the best short film on this. That's how impressed I was.
It's very nice of you to say. I appreciate all the love. Seriously, it's we all work very hard on these things. So to hear that it affected someone and someone responded to it, even if it's just one person, it still means a lot, truly.
Kyle, were you able to capture your vision that you had in your head? And how would you have changed it if somebody said, here's an extra $1 million?
Oh, yeah, that's a fantastic question. I think so. I don't know if I'm a director who I think, you know, has everything figured out, like even the day before production. And this was, we shot for one day. And so I would say that, like, even the night before, there was like moments of, man, I wonder if there's this magic that we're going to be able to capture. Cause I think in writing the script, in full transparency, it took probably I was writing for a year, based upon a handful of different observations and experiences in similar rooms like this. Also having a lot of conversations with people. And I would say even up till 2 months before we shot, I mean, we were actually kind of thinking we were going to do it all as in like one long take. And that actually shifted probably about 2 months beforehand, where we did feel like it might actually be compelling to jump into the casting camera perspective itself. And so it got broken up into three shots right then. Then I would say when we brought Luke and Kevin and Mather and Melanie on, there's that process of sort of hearing those words come to life and get on their feet and see what is working and what isn't working. The shape of the first, we had two rehearsals that took place, I would say a week before and then one day before we actually shot. Inside of that week, I would say it was really starting to solidify of like inside of my head of like the pathway where we were being able to head and some of the juicy complexities that were sort of starting to come out. But then even some things that were even becoming more complex that I thought, you know, all of us really started to be able to like be like, oh, what if this reaction led to this potential line? And of course, you know, someone like Kevin Dunn, who has 40 years experience in similar rooms, you know, there was even some like one or two lines that he mentioned that was like, oh, that adds another layer to the potential background and the history of even these men inside of this room and their relationship. Cause the whole film is sort of about excavating power dynamics. So I would say, like, things shifted and evolved, especially in those last final days before we shot. But I feel like there's a magic that all of us as filmmakers are attempting to try to hit record and literally, like, you know, capture it. And I think that if you gave me $1 million would I change anything? You know, there's things inside of it that I would say, like, I always learn as a filmmaker who's attempting to progress as a storyteller. There's potential lines that, you know, certain people may not necessarily like, that maybe wash over certain people. There's certain moments that many people like may absolutely embrace and take in and understand exactly what we were attempting to achieve in this one moment. But I think that the sort of imperfections of it is actually, I think, what offers so much and invites so many like more people into it to watch, and the countless different perspectives who I've had like very hard conversations with, very beautiful conversations with, and illuminating conversations that may not even share these exact perspectives that are inside of this room, but I think that it didn't feel like we were attempting to crystallize one perfect shot with everything exactly the way we wanted it. It felt like we were attempting to excavate the realities behind entering into a space, leaving this very, you know, potentially realistic room with feeling something absolutely shifted underneath us. Even if we couldn't put our finger on it, you know, we knew something did, and many of us would have a different take on potentially what happened. Those conversations have been very, very heartening, you know? So I don't know if I would actually change anything particular on this. I think, you know, if we had 5 days to shoot, we'd probably be trying to chase something very, you know, similar. And I don't know if those, it might be diminishing returns potentially, because I feel like we there was an excitement and an energy for a 1 day shoot for the attempt, the massive challenges that we were attempting to accomplish. And I think that sort of like excitement, titillation in the room of like, can we achieve this? I think added to the actual tension in the room, you know?
So one of the questions always that actors have is, so what's on the craft service table? Did you have one, or could you use $1 million for that?
You know, that's a great point. Like, you know, friends were making great food for us, for lunch and for dinner. Yeah, we would get, I'd put in some amazing food and we had a craft services table, but it wasn't one that was very illustrious, not nearly to the ones that we have here.
You know, every filmmaker is going to be asking me, and so I've got to ask you, is how did you get this cast for a short?
Oh, man. You know, there's a certain amount of luck. There's a certain, and I'd also tip my hat to my casting directors, Caitlin and Jen. They were actually associates when I knew them, for extremely successful casting directors themselves, and been really sort of, you know, groomed and mentored to the point where they were about to jump, and they ended up doing that. And this was actually unofficially the first project that they worked on together. And I think in conversations with them, and I would say the script potentially found its real audience very early on, because it's about casting session. And so the casting directors sort of talking to you about casting directors was like a very fun conversation to have for several meals that we had. And I think that they were actually very excited, because several like films that even attempt to depict their jobs actually are very, you know, reductive and rely on stereotypes to potentially very like judgmental, you know, individuals. And I think this was trying to like find something different, very like complex inside of every person in the room. But Jen and Caitlin, you know, their mantra was like, let's, you know, don't think that we can't aim too high, but also like, I think, let's be very, you know, realistic and not waste too much time, you know? And with that said, I think, you know, Luke was absolutely the first, choice for the role, and for Brandon. He was someone I had just really watched Crown Heights, a film that he was in that went to Sundance, and Then I watched Atlanta. He's in my favorite episode of Atlanta. There was something that when I saw those two, I knew that he had not only an insane range, but I think you mentioned it earlier, and I've said it before, he does things with his face that not many human beings can do. It's just simply the truth. His facial control and muscles are just like on a different level. And then with Kevin, I think we knew a big reach and, someone who says no to pilots and has been a working actor for countless years in Hollywood and worked with some of the best directors, in the world. I think when Caitlin and Jen mentioned him as an idea, I had always been a fan of him. I worked at a video store when I was 16 in my small hometown and have always loved Kevin Dunn from, Stir of Echoes to Snake Eyes. I mean, you just go down the list. And I thought that it was going to be a big reach for him. They talked with his manager, who was attempting to politely and very respectfully guide them into different directions. And we were just politely persistent. It was that thing where we sent the script. And if the manager didn't respond to it, then it would be moot and we'd be able to move on. But, the manager ended up, or at least Caitlin and Jen woke up the next day to an email that said, okay, prepare your offer. And I think that we knew that the script had something that potentially was worth excavating at that point, but we didn't have the finances that we're going to ever do anything or be motivating. And it was never going to be the motivating factor for a part like this, because short films just aren't. So I wrote him a letter and then he ended up giving me a call, I think, the next day, and we talked for a good hour and a half, and then we got coffee, and then he was like, after talking about the character of Jack and sort of the intentions behind every angle in the film, I think he was like, I'm in. And Mather and Melanie too. I wouldn't want to overtalk it, but Mather and Melanie were also I think really big gets for this film. That Mather's ability to have such improvisational comedy and be a showman in a room, but then instantaneously flip and be someone who can show just a lot of resonance and emotional weight, that is a really hard thing to do. And Melanie was sort of a pure heart in the film that needed to kind of have a little bit of innocence, be stripped away as potentially the biggest tragedy inside of the film. And she flew from New York after having her kid, and that type of commitment was something that was, again, extremely heartening. The four really came to play, and it was, we approached it like theater. They were learning lines off book, and we were going for very long streams, or I guess stretches of the script. During rehearsal, it was a really kind of deepening process of examining all of these characters. One that I think was we all relished it.
How many takes were you able to take on the project?
For the first shot, we did 12. It was really the idea of trying to get it as many times before lunch, really. And in the second, the second rehearsal was the one where we were able to bring in camera, which was the day before. Mm-hmm. So we started to see kind of how things were starting to play. Really, we were only there for, I think, an hour and a half or two. So then we really were trying to come up and show up on that day of. And once we got through makeup and costume, really just trying to fly. Because that was a challenge. We ended up getting 12 off of the first one, and then the casting camera, we did I think like 6 takes of it, and then I think the next the final shot, I think we did I want to say 6 or 7.
Well, it was extremely well done. I was actually speechless after watching it. What was it that you were able to qualify for the become an Oscar contender?
It actually happened twofold, which was sort of serendipitous and harmonious and something you can't predict. I think that the film had gotten a certain amount of attention after its world premiere in at Palm Springs and then its international premiere at Rain Dance, where there was a little bit of press and circulation of just, I think, that was noteworthy in a response that felt like it was actually very, positive. And then, my publicist was, who has a ton of experience, I think in the last 5-6 years with the Oscars, was sort of like, it seems like it makes sense to potentially go through a ton of festivals and see if we actually have that magic of winning one of the few awards that is actually at a Oscar qualifying fest. But at the same time, let's put it in a theater for a week and actually qualify, for four-walling it. In this day and age, the idea of putting it in a theater was sort of a little strange. So we just really had the intent to screen. And then since the theater didn't open, we still qualified. But then at that same exact moment, again, serendipitous, we actually won Best of Fest Award at St. Louis International Film Fest, which was sort of crazy and very cool and great that audience even found it too. So we were really, really extremely excited.
And you personally won an award from the Hollywood Foreign Film Press that I read in your bio.
Yeah, that was back in school. Exactly. Yeah. At UCLA grad school. Yeah. There was, I won the Stanley Kramer Award and the Hollywood Foreign Press Award too, really was sort of a collection of works there.
Well, I know quite a few people are going to want to get to know you when I say where you worked at before Plan B with Brad Pitt.
Right. Yep.
People always knocking on your door. Hey, can you give me Brad's number? Give me Brad's number. You were an executive development there. What exactly was your job? Did you find the projects for Brad, or did you find projects for the company?
I was there for about a little over 6.5 years. I started when the company was really in a closet of his management company. It was right after Tree of Life. I started as an intern, and then I was an assistant, and then I worked up to be what's called a creative executive. Plan B really functions not as like a Brad Pitt, it's not a shingle for him and a vehicle for him a lot of the films that were on our slate at the time and the two presidents, the co-presidents of the company are named Jerry McCliner and Dee Dee Gardner. He gives them a ton of freedom to make a lot of stuff. I think he was only attached to like two or three projects of the 60 that were on the slate. I came up on an executive there named Sarah Esberg. It was really just the three of them and a handful of assistants. And then I got moved up. I would say, the main thing is you're reading a ton. You're ingesting a lot of material. You're watching countless shorts from different film festivals. You're reading articles and books. And a lot of what we were doing was IP-based. And so there was a lot of reading material and filtering out a lot of the stuff that wasn't right, but then trying to find the things that either could be TV shows or potentially films. We were all doing that process, and I think Jeremy and Dee Dee were extremely well. They knew exactly how to do that because they had been doing it for so long with Brad. They had been there, I think, at that point, but 14 years. I was learning a lot from them, and it was really, I think, indirectly and directly learning from three amazing producers as really the junior exec there.
Are there three points that you could give us for young writers on what you would look for in a script when you're at his company?
Whether here at Big Beach or at Plan B, I think things that I look for are... there has to be a level of inventiveness. I think both companies I'm very lucky and fortunate to work for two places that I think chase art with a capital A and are very voice driven. And so I think there's countless tropes that are absolutely exercised inside of scripts that I think that you become very well versed in when you're reading so much material and you're just taking in so much material. So I think I was constantly looking for something that was just different. And then I would say something that is probably really hard to do is I was looking for something experiential, which is probably the hardest thing to do as a writer. And what I mean by that is there's scripts that can be really phenomenal, but I think when you read them, they end up just feeling like there's something missing that you almost is undefinable. But the person who can walk you through a narrative so well on page and understands that that will be a different experience, that it is, you know, taken on upon by the director. Those experiential reads are really, really challenging to write. And yet when you read it, that, you know, you're pouring through a 150 page script because you need to, I think that's a rare experience. And then the third thing I would say would probably just be emotional honesty. You know, there's anything from Moonlight, from the first time, you know, we read that script, to all the way to scripts with magical realism, science fiction epics and genre films. There's potentially moments of real vulnerability. There's real character dynamics. There's real a thought behind the human beings who are in the script, if there are human beings in the script. But I think that those were the films that we were tending to make at Plan B and same mm-hmm. thing at Big Beach. The themes inside of those emotional honest moments and dynamics are the key. I mean, we were never going to do, and I don't work for a company now that is going to make something that's just a good beginning, middle, and end, you know? I think it has to have something to say. I think it has to have the author and the auteur and the writers and the voices behind it have something to say. And potentially it's political, but probably not, especially in this day and age where politics are just dripping through everything. It probably has something to say about us as humans. It probably has something to say that can allow the film to elevate itself beyond just like an amazing watch, you know?
Well, you've made a change into a bigger position. You're now an executive producer on a TV series for Amazon Prime. The Constitution means to you. What was the process of casting that? Were you involved in that, or did you walk into the project already, or?
What the Constitution means to me is actually a strange, it's a variety special, actually. We recorded with the director, Mariel Heller, who we have a first look deal with. She and the Broadway playwright and performer, Heidi Schreck, her play had been on Broadway for, and had really been in countless different runs for several years. They approached us that they wanted to create a different type of special. They wanted to do a recording of her play, and that its themes inside of the rights that women have and do not have inside of this country, through the specific lens of Heidi and her relationship with her mother and her grandmother and her actual family history to Wenatchee, Washington. There was a lot of things that felt like it became even more and more and more timely. So we signed on to it. We wanted to jump in. We ended up recording and shooting it last August while it was in its last week of its run. And then we were in post over the summer. And I think that it was a long post process because Heidi had her twins in May and Mari had another baby in August. We ended up delivering it and then airing it in Amazon. I think Amazon aired it in middle of October.
How much you see social media affecting the role of writers and actors and from your company's perspective?
It's a good question, because I think that like it does envelop a lot of our lives, and so sometimes you have to say, like, you know, is this there even now, like, is this like a post-pandemic or a pre-pandemic narrative? And I think before that it was like, is this a pre-Facebook or post-Facebook, you know, or pre-cell phone or post-cell phone narrative? There's times where you can tell that individuals are attempting to chase what is out there in the ether, and by doing so, they're showing that they're actually being reactive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a dangerous place to be in as a creative, as a writer, as a director. I think that the best place to be in as and it's going to be come from a purist standpoint, so just, you know, bear with me, but I would say that writers and creators who are attempting to just create, and maybe not in a vacuum, but not like in response to things, is potentially the best manner. But there is like while at the same time having an awareness of sort of the world and the state of the world that you're actually putting your narratives out, and how your themes are actually resonating to the things that are going out. So it's an awareness, but I think it's a slippery slope.
Great. Any last comments that you'd like to throw into young actors and producers and on making it in Hollywood?
I think you're, you know, there was advice given to me, which was you're trying to throw a pass to yourself that you're going to be able to catch in like 20 years. That actually starts to hit home. I've been in the city for 12 years after going to grad school here, and the amount of like mistakes that I was making in film school, and whether it was just on set through, you know, messing up relationships, or actually just, you know, making fumbling narratives that I was attempting to helm. You learn a lot through mistakes, and those mistakes are actually really great, but you can't pressurize it that you actually have to like create something now that's amazing. You're actually building a career, and so it's a harder idea to get around your head around. Mm-hmm. but a lot of those things that I think that I had fortunately made in terms of mistakes have led to, you know, the company that I'm at now, and even the position I'm at, but also Josiah as a short film.
Fantastic. I really appreciate you being on School of Hollywood today, and look forward to seeing you at the Oscars.
Thank you so much. From your mouth to everyone's ears, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the School of Hollywood. Please follow us on Instagram at School of Hollywood and subscribe so you can hear our next episode. I'm Steve Owens. Until next time, continue to follow your dreams and look to the stars for your success.